Welcome to Background Briefing. This is Howard Bloom sitting in for Ian Masters. On today's show, we're going to talk to Ali Al-Ahmed, a Saudi journalist who continues to have the courage to speak out against his country's repressive government, even though such words could get him killed. This journalist also has some choice words for how our government is managing its foreign policy with the authoritarian Saudi monarchy. We're also going to talk to LA Times columnist Michael Hiltzik about a growing movement to win the right to let you fix your things or fix other people's things. You know, things like your iPhone or your laptop. Apple is not happy and is not taking this lying down. But first, it didn't get the attention of the Brett Kavanaugh Supreme Court nomination, but the nomination of Thomas Farr to be a federal district judge has sent off all sorts of alarm bells among civil rights activists. Farr is an attorney who has devoted a substantial part of his career to suppressing the black vote in North Carolina. Notably, in 1984 and 1990, he was part of efforts that targeted black voters that were intended to intimidate them, making them less likely to vote. In the years since, he seems to have been the go-to lawyer for those who want to suppress the black vote and to defend those efforts against legal challenge. With us to talk about the nomination of Thomas Farr is Kristen Clark. She's the president and executive director of the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law. She formerly served as the head of the Civil Rights Bureau for New York State Attorney General Eric Schneiderman, then spent several years at the NAACP Legal Defense and Educational Fund, where she testified before Congress and state legislatures. She also served as a federal prosecutor in the U.S. Department of Justice in the Civil Rights Division, and she is the author of Barack Obama and African-American Empowerment, The Rise of Black America's New Leadership. Kristen Clark, welcome to Background Briefing.
Thank you so much for having me.
We'll walk our way through key points of Mr. Farr's career, but first tell us what job he was nominated for and what is the role of the U.S. Senate in this process?
Sure. Thomas Farr was nominated for a seat on the Federal District Court for the Eastern District of North Carolina. And this is an interesting area. It's an area that's about 27% African American, and they've never had an African American judge. There were two women, both African American, nominated by President Obama, who never received a hearing. That's one of the longest vacancies that's been sitting on the federal court system.
And not only is it an area with a significant African-American population, but certainly an area where the African-American vote and the right to vote, there's a history there.
That's right. Yeah, no, North Carolina has been front and center in debates about voter suppression in our country. This is a state that has made extraordinary attempts to silence the voices of African Americans in recent years, but sadly throughout the state's history.
And it also turns out that Mr. Farr played a significant role in those. And let's get to that. In the U.S. Senate campaigns of Jesse Helms in 1984 and 1990, now I know that was a long time ago, but the conduct was so notable it bears repeating in some detail. Can you tell us what he was involved in those campaigns?
Yeah. So Jesse Helms ran for office a number of times, but I'll focus in particular on his run in the early 90s and in 1984. During both of those eras, it's very interesting kind of what's playing out in the South. Jesse Jackson is running for president in the 80s, and there are grassroots efforts underway to reach individuals who had not yet been registered to vote. And in North Carolina, you started to see significant increases in people who were inspired by Jesse Jackson's run and inspired by a lot of the mobilization efforts that were underway. And the Helms campaign was really bent on figuring out what to do with all of these new black voters. And so in 1984, the campaign issued postcards that were sent out with almost surgical precision to African Americans. And those postcards basically said that you may not be eligible to vote, and if you turn out to the polls, you could be subject to arrest. There was an article that I was reading from this time period that described, you know, mixed race, interracial couples, where the African American spouse in the household received the postcard, but the white spouse did not. I mean, that is how laser focused they were on getting these postcards into the hands of black voters.
And they were so impressed with how well the strategy worked that they essentially did it again in 1990.
They did it again in 1990. Incredibly intimidating to get one of these postcards, and you can imagine the chilling effect it had on somebody who received it. Let me read you the text. If you moved from your old precinct over 30 days ago, contact the County Board of Elections for instructions. When you enter the voting enclosure, you'll be asked to state your name, residence, and period of residence in that precinct. You must have lived in that precinct for at least the previous 30 days, or you will not be allowed to vote. It is a federal crime punishable by up to 5 years in jail to knowingly give false information about your name, residence, or period of residence to an election official. I mean, these are postcards that were sent with one specific purpose, and that was to discourage, deter, and intimidate African Americans from turning out to the polls.
Needless to say, just about everything that postcard is wrong.
That's right.
Not only was it meant to intimidate black voters, but it was to intimidate them with information about their rights to vote and the penalties they face. That was completely incorrect. And they, of
That's
course,
right.
knew it. And it turns out that Farr, it appears, based on credible evidence, that he had a role in developing and promulgating the strategy. And then when it was challenged legally, he was the guy who defended it.
That's right. Now, here he is nominated for a seat on the federal court. And in response to a written question, he said that he didn't know about the postcard campaign and seemed to try to distance himself from it. A game-changing moment. I mean, everybody doubted the veracity of that claim. And, you know that he was the attorney for the Jesse Helms campaign and know that he absolutely had a hand in that intimidation effort. On Tuesday night, a Justice Department memo from the early 90s was revealed. And the Justice Department under President George H.W. Bush was conducting an investigation into this intimidation campaign. And the memo contained evidence and information that clearly identified Farr as the architect of this mail scheme. The Justice Department, in their own words, said that Farr was the architect for both efforts in 1984 and 1990.
Right. His name is all over that memo. So it's all over.
But identifying him as the architect, I think, was a real game-changing moment. It was a far cry away from how he had described himself as somebody who was very distant from the scheme. In my view, everything should have come to a grinding halt at that point. I think there are questions about whether he lied to the Senate. But we don't need voter suppression endorsed in this way. Thomas Farr is somebody who's dedicated his entire professional career to defending and designing voter suppression efforts.
Let's get to that. Because these efforts were not a youthful indiscretion, although if your youthful indiscretion is coordinating a form of racism, that might be disqualifying on its face. But this wasn't something that he turned away from or later announced. This is basically a major portion of his career. And could you run through some of the more recent voter suppression efforts that he was involved in?
Yeah, let's talk about the monster voter suppression law. So this is a law that sought to make it harder for people to vote in North Carolina in every respect. This is a bill that was passed in the wake of the Supreme Court's ruling issued in 2013, Shelby County, Alabama v. Holder, a case that cut out the heart of the Voting Rights Act, a provision that required that many counties in North Carolina and other parts of the country get federal review of new voting changes before they could be put into effect. That core provision of the Voting Rights Act helped to block and deter hundreds of discriminatory voting laws that otherwise would have made it onto the books. We're now in a world without the full protections of the Voting Rights Act, and officials in North Carolina have exploited that to the fullest extent. They adopted a bill that cut back early voting hours, eliminated same-day registration, eliminated pre-registration opportunities for 16 and 17-year-olds. I mean, you name it, anything that would make it harder for people to vote, that's exactly what they did.
and not just harder to vote, but they studied measures, voting measures that were especially helpful and used by African-American voters and other minority voters. So if it was a voting measure that, say, was more likely to be used by white voters, that was not targeted. In fact, wasn't the court ruling about this say that these measures were designed with surgical precision to target black voters?
They were. And the provision that was probably the focal point for the court was the way in which the state cut early voting hours. You have sold to the polls in North Carolina, and a lot of, you know, churches that were encouraging congregants to go out and vote after attending church on Sunday. And African Americans really availed themselves of the opportunity to go out and early vote in North Carolina and did so in record numbers. Officials got that data and saw precisely when and where black voters were turning out to early vote in high numbers, and they cut early voting hours in a way that the court described as being carried out with almost surgical precision. So North Carolina is just a textbook example of all that's gone wrong in the country since the Roberts Court issued that 2013 ruling in Shelby County, Alabama v. Holder. Thomas Farr, the hired gun here, he was the one who defended the state as this monster voter suppression bill made its way through the court, just as he has throughout his career. Whenever voter suppression has reared its ugly head, he is the lawyer there defending these bad schemes and efforts. And as we saw as far back as 1984, he's sometimes the mastermind and the architect as well.
You are tuned into Background Briefing with Howard Bloom, sitting in for Ian Masters. With us to talk about the federal judicial nomination of Thomas Farr is Kristen Clark. She's the president and executive director of the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law. Farr has spent a significant proportion of his career trying to suppress the black vote and legally defending such efforts. Now, it turns out that this nomination, which as far as reaching the floor, just narrowly squeaked through. Now there's a considerable doubt about whether this nomination will be successful because a key Republican, Tim Scott, who's the one black Republican senator, and he's from South Carolina, he's now announced that he will not support Thomas Farr. So tell us where this nomination stands.
Well, for all intents and purposes, it's dead. This nomination will not go forward because they don't have the requisite number of votes in the Senate.
Are they likely to bring it back when the Republican majority in the Senate actually increases to 53, or do you think that's not likely?
You know, that's a possibility, but that would most certainly be shameful. We used to be in a world where judicial nominees had to garner 60 votes because we've always lived by the idea that nominees should enjoy some level of bipartisan support when we're talking about lifetime seats on our nation's federal courts. Here, where you have a nominee who was so polarizing and so divisive and who garnered such opposition from every corner of the country, it would be disgraceful for anyone to resurrect this nomination in 2019.
There were two highly qualified African-American women who had previously been nominated by President Obama for this very judgeship. Can you remind us who they were?
There are two extremely qualified African-American women, Jennifer May Parker. She served as the chief of the appellate division at the U.S. Attorney's Office, and Patricia Simmons Goodson, a former North Carolina Supreme Court justice and now current vice chair of the United States Commission on Civil Rights. These women had impeccable credentials, strong records, no evidence of bias, and didn't get a chance to be heard because of the obstruction that has prevailed inside the Senate. This district, which Thomas Farr was nominated again, has a very significant African-American population. They've never had an African-American judge. And one thing that's for sure is that President Trump has really turned the clock back when it comes to racial diversity on our courts and gender diversity. In recent time, we've not seen presidents who have put forth slates of nominees that are so woefully lacking in diversity in the way that we're seeing now. Again, this all stands to damage in an irreparable way the reputation and integrity of our courts, and truly requires that people speak out and speak loudly against the way in which this administration is damaging our courts. Look, there are seats on the court that need to be filled, and this administration has to do a better job identifying nominees who will be fair and independent. Thomas Barr defies those principles in every respect.
It's impressive, the nerve of the Trump administration in pushing forward this nomination. Who would have thought that Thomas Barr would be a U.S. district judge rather than just merely a hired gun for voter suppression?
Yeah, and you know, that's been the case with many of the nominees we've seen in this era. We've seen nominees who espouse really troubling views. One nominee who quietly blogged support for the KKK. Another nominee who openly expressed the view that transgender children are Satan's children. We've really seen judges who are true outliers in terms of their extremist outlook and their judicial philosophy. These are nominees who are biased, who harbor intensely partisan views, intense racial views. It is hard to imagine a federal court system that continues to maintain any integrity or garner any confidence among the public when you have judges who clearly cannot fairly evaluate the cases that come before them.
And so even though you have a case like Barr, because of his very specific record, who draws a lot of attention, there are people who may have views just as worrisome as Barr, but who don't have his record, who are still being nominated for the federal courts here.
That's right. This is an area where we really need the public to pay more attention, because our courts are changing dramatically under this administration, installing judges who are outside the mainstream, outside the legal mainstream, judges who are real radical, judges who are young. It's really important that the public engage here and speak out and speak up. We saw that with the Thomas Barr nomination. My colleagues over at the NAACP had people who bust up from North Carolina to urge Senator Scott to oppose the Barr nomination, and it really exemplifies the kind of engagement that we need to see on judicial nominations as we go forward. The Supreme Court has been an intense battleground, but we can't forget that about 99.9% of cases get heard by the lower federal district and appellate courts, so people really need to speak up here.
My guest has been Kristen Clark. She's the president and executive director of the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under the Law. Thank you so much for sharing some time with us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
Later on in the show, we're going to talk to LA Times columnist Michael Hiltzik about a growing movement to have you win the right to fix your things or fix other people's things, things like your iPhone or your laptop computer. Apple and other major technology companies are not very happy about it. But coming up next, we're going to look at whether the murder of a Washington Post journalist has any potential to change the way people think about and deal with Saudi Arabia.
We shall overcome. We shall overcome. We shall overcome.
Joining us now is Ali Al-Ahmed, the founder and director of the Institute for Gulf Affairs and a scholar and expert on Saudi political affairs, including terrorism, Islamic movements, Wahhabi Islam, Saudi political history, and Saudi-American relations. He also knows a lot about the Al Saud family history. Welcome to Background Briefing.
Well, thank you so much for having me again.
Well, we know that Saudi operatives killed Jamal Khashoggi on October 2nd of this year at the Saudi consulate in Istanbul, Turkey, And of that, President Donald Trump has famously said about the role of Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman of the killing, maybe he did and maybe he didn't. And President Trump suggests that he doesn't really care one way or the other. So just right off the bat, what do you make of that reaction of President Trump to the killing of Jamal Khashoggi?
You know, Mr. Trump, I give him credit for being honest about his feeling, about his position. I would assume from previous presidents that would have been the same position, but using different words and maybe making it a much more flowery language. But at the end of the day, the American position would have been the same, regardless of Trump or Obama or Carter were president, because the U.S. support for the Saudi absolute monarchy has been consistent, and it has been repeated throughout the administration, both the Democratic and Republican administrations.
Right, and I was going to ask you, in fact, it's the next question on my list here, would President Obama have reacted any differently? And you kind of answered that already. You said not in substance, but I don't know. I mean, style may count for something. Do you give President Trump more points for being dead honest about it? Or would you give Obama some points if he expressed some outrage at the act itself?
I think I would give honesty a greater credit than fake humanitarian. Let us remember that President Obama has said nothing about this affair, although he is not the president and he has the liberty. You know, he's not running for office, but he hasn't said anything. Many people have commented, but you notice that he and Hillary Clinton even and Bill Clinton kind of have dodged this issue, and the media has not brought it up. It is important to realize that Mr. Obama supported actively, and that's my information, the Saudi war on Yemen and the Saudi crushing of the uprising in Bahrain, the democratic uprising. Yemen, much greater traffic than killing Mr. Khashoggi. I think the Khashoggi matter would not have been as prominent as if it happened during the Obama administration, because the Obama administration would have been able to skillfully avoid and dodge this issue.
Well, it's interesting. In many ways, the Trump administration seems in so many ways to be a house divided. And you have to think that the leak of the CIA's conclusion about the killing was meant to limit or undermine what Trump was likely to claim about it, because would there have been that leak about the CIA conclusion during the Obama administration, or do you think this is, again, representing some of this division within the Trump administration?
I believe so. I think there are more ranking file in the American government who have issues with Trump. So there are more people in the administration that do not like Trump, more so than when Obama was president. So, yes, I think some people were trying to embarrass him. However, my information that this CIA leak came not from the CIA, it came from Congress and, you know, specifically Democratic members and some Republicans who the CIA briefed on the audio.
Speaking of Congress, and one of the latest twists to this story, Trump has refused to let his CIA director, Gina Haspel, testify to Congress about the killing, and that has kind of fueled the upset in the Senate about this case.
I wasn't surprised, but I think there has been sort of a political football here regarding this issue. It is sometimes some people are doing it because it's anti-Trump, more so than pro Mr. Khashoggi or this cause of journalism. Because many people who cry tears over Mr. Khashoggi, they are still continuing and calling for a greater expansion of war in Yemen, for example. So they do not start from a humanitarian position, but I think it's more so the political gains. I'm not saying all of them are, but a great number of them are, including the Washington Post. I can say something that might sound a little bit weird, but the Washington Post has not called me, for example. I am a journalist. I am from Saudi Arabia. I wrote columns. And they have not called me to ask me if I am fine or invite me to, for example, to write something about this issue. And, you know, this is Washington.
What about your situation? Have you thought about what happened to him and what that means to the diaspora, especially people like you who write and speak freely about these issues? What about this? Do you feel that you are at risk?
Absolutely, I am at risk. Not only I feel it, I am at risk, because we have evidence to that. We have evidence of spying and surveillance and, you know, physical evidence to that. the AP story a few weeks ago about the attempts to hack our email and our computers. So there is real efforts on the Saudis. That could have been me. I mean, they have tried to lure me outside the United States like they did with Khashoggi. It's very costly for them to do anything here. They have spied here. Absolutely, they did. But they have not tried physical harm here. And I think they know if they do it here, the cost will be greater. The Khashoggi murder, unfortunately, has been used sometimes by some people. I wouldn't say all, but a certain number of people has political football between the Democrats and the Republicans, or the anti-Trump, the pro-Trump, and so on.
My guest is Ali Al-Ahmed. He's the founder and director of the Institute for Gulf Affairs and a scholar and expert on Saudi political affairs. And because of that, he, too, is in the crosshairs of the Saudi regime, which apparently you don't have to be very critical of the Saudi regime to be on their list. I mean, it does seem as though even if the American administration, whether it was Trump or Obama or George W. Bush, even if they weren't going to sever ties with the Saudis, they could at least take all measures to protect journalists and dissidents when they have the opportunity to. And I'm just wondering, has there been any attempt by U.S. officials to make sure that you are safe, for example?
I can tell you I have not received a call or a request for a meeting following the murder of Mr. Khashoggi. I thought that would happen. There should be some kind of the Justice Department and the American government should start looking into this issue. Are the Saudis doing this? And we gave evidence why this should happen. The fact that, the Saudis could do this, could actually come and shoot me and others maybe who are critical.
You've also raised some concerns about a pending corporate merger. Talk about that.
There is a merger that's happening, actually, between T-Mobile and Sprint, and the Saudis are going to be part owner of that company, which is the third largest mobile provider in the United States. That gives them access to millions of mobile phones, including mine, which I have, T-Mobile. So that is something that should have been investigated, but it reminds me of the post-9/11 attack. The Saudi role in that was not investigated, was not pursued, and here we are basically having another round of that. It is for the U.S. sovereignty and protection and security that this should be looked into.
At this point, we cannot save Jamal Khashoggi, but there are plenty of other dissidents and writers and activists who are still alive or who are at risk and who are being abused but are still alive, who actually their situation could be helped at this point.
Yeah, well, I think that's very easy. If the U.S. should send a clear message that this should not happen, that Mr. Khashoggi, I'm going to do something hopefully next week about it, was lured from here to Turkey. With Saudi, was told him here to go there. And that was part of the, and I think the American government knows this.
So the administration is contending that Iran is the evildoer in Yemen and more broadly in the Middle East, and that Saudi Arabia is the force for stability and security. What do you make of that claim?
I think this is a farce, to say the least. Yes, Iran is involved in supporting people in Yemen, Ansarullah, or they know them in the West as Houthis. It happened, but if you look at the support is comparatively to the American, the Houthis do not have an air force or tanks. They are ragtag army, and their best weapons are these missiles that they shoot from time to time at the Saudi territory. So I think there is an attempt here to rewrite reality. The reality is the Americans and the British, including British fighters, who have been helping in bombing Yemen for over 3 years. More bombs have fallen in Yemen than any country that I know, and killed, according to a British charity, more than 85,000 children. And the number's probably higher because of starvation and disease and bombing. If you combine all of these, it's probably over 100,000 child, let alone other civilians. So I think some people are trying to hide and justify the U.S. and British support for the Saudi war crimes in Yemen by saying Iran is at fault. Iran definitely is at fault, but Iran's role in Yemen is very minimal comparatively to the Saudis or the Americans, the British and the French and all other countries that are involved in this war. And in fact, all of those people who signed on this war, including those people in the UN Security Council, bear the blame for this war. they cannot wash their hand away from it because children have died in their thousands.
As we're having this conversation, international leaders are taking part in an economic summit in Buenos Aires. Donald Trump is there. So is Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. Any thoughts about this gathering and what we learn from watching how the international leaders are behaving among each other?
That was a very clear attempt by the Saudis, and I think with some support from the French and others too, to bring back and to bury this issue of the murder of Jamal Khashoggi. I watched the conversation between Macron and Mohammed bin Salman, and it looks like that they are going to, or he's suggesting that, you know, they will do the same thing that they did in Bahrain, establish, quote-unquote, a royal commission with international experts like the Bassouni Commission in Bahrain at the end to gain credibility, because this is an outside, it's not the UN inquiry into this matter, and the king would appoint this commission, pick some jurist or a lawyer or whatever from France or something. They will conduct their investigation and say, oh, the crown prince was not involved, to give this legitimacy, to make it go away. They did this in Bahrain at the British suggestion. And it worked well for the Bahrain monarchy because the king appeared to be the person who wants to find the truth. But the end goal was to clear the ruling family from the crimes that they committed in Bahrain. And then they're going to do the same here, I think.
Well, I've heard it suggested that if the U.S. and its allies were really interested in this issue, they might not be able to make somebody like Mohammed bin Salman stand trial, but they could use their influence to push him out of the line of succession so that somebody else would be the person who would take over the kingdom. Do you see that as something that was within the power or is still within the power of the U.S. and its allies?
Yeah, it's within the power of the U.S. Mohammed bin Salman was brought to the throne by the support of the Trump administration. It was the Obama administration that pushed and supported the rise of Mohammed bin Naif, who was now deposed. So the U.S. has been involved in with the succession process in Saudi Arabia and picking the leader of that country for many years. So
this is a case where the U.S. actually has some strength and is arguably taking a weak position of subservience to what it feels the Saudis want.
It's not about what the Saudis want alone, but it's also about what the United States wants. And the U.S. want to keep this guy in power. I don't think they want to replace him. It is advantageous for the U.S. because he is injured, he is weakened, so he is going to become more dependent on the Americans and the British and the French.
I see.
And that will give those countries greater leverage.
Within the region, within the Middle East, how is Trump's handling of this situation viewed? What message is it sending within the region?
You know, this killing of Mr. Khashoggi has actually gotten a lot of people upset. And they view the U.S. and Trump as basically supporting a cold-blooded murderer. And they are not happy with Mr. Trump, obviously. And with the United States, and basically saying that, oh, we thought you say you are for democracy, but here it looks like that this is all empty words. And that has been the case for a long time. And I think what Mr. Trump did, he made it clear. Now people realize that's the fact. And this is something experts like myself knew many years ago, but the average Middle Eastern person did not know this because they heard the beautiful orator of Mr. Obama. He's going to stand with those who stand for their rights, but his policy was the opposite of his words. But Mr. Trump is very, and I think that's why I tweeted a couple of weeks ago that I really thank him because he made it clear. What was hidden is now clear, and I think that helps us make a case for change in our region and to have a system answerable to the people, not to outside power, a system that is by the people.
It seems the perfect crime in this situation is one in which, I mean, if you're the crown prince, the perfect crime is when the people who have reason to fear you are certain that you ordered the killing, but those people who want to make excuses for you can claim that there's no rock-solid proof. And basically, you want there to be this duality of message from this killing.
Yeah, I think so. us. I can tell you, since the killing, I've seen, and I predicted this years ago, you see many more Saudi young men popping out of the woodwork, attacking the Mohammed bin Salman and the Saudi monarchy. It's amazing. You know, every day, almost, there is a new person on Twitter, either they fled to Canada or London, and even from there inside the country. This murder has galvanized many people, especially in the country. And that, I think, is much more important. You know, when you have hundreds of people who join the critics because of this murder, joins in against the monarchy, this wave, I think, will grow. It will snowball, I believe, in the next few months.
And as you pointed out earlier, as awful as the killing of Khashoggi is, it is hardly the worst atrocity going on. You have the hundreds of thousands of people, maybe it's going to be millions by the time we're done, in Yemen, who are either suffering or have lost their lives. 28 million people, at least half the population, at risk of famine. And you have Saudi women activists who have been subjected to electric shocks and beatings. You have arbitrary arrest detentions. There's plenty wrong here besides the killing of Jamal Khashoggi.
It is absolutely correct that the Jamal Khashoggi is not the first or the worst crime that committed by the Saudi monarchy. But for some reason, it had caught people's attention, and because maybe he was in the U.S., and the New York Times, after the Washington Post, pushed for this, and or maybe because it's just over this fighting between Trump and certain media outlets. We never know, really.
Researching this, I noted this Washington Post report in October that Saudi royalty has been buying from the Trump Organization since 1995, and that Saudi lobbyists spent $270,000 last year to reserve rooms in Trump's hotel in Washington, and that Trump hotels in New York and Chicago reported significant increases in bookings from Saudi visitors. Is it worth mentioning that, or does that seem irrelevant in the situation?
I mean, I think it is when it comes to every American president, governments in the Gulf, Saudi Arabia and others, try to kind of buy favors with these presidents, either by, booking the Trump Hotel in D.C. for their events, or by giving money to the Clinton Foundation. And both had happened. So it's not a Trump issue alone. It's bipartisan, and it's not surprising. But I don't think this is the big stuff we usually don't know about, because they do it in such a way that it's almost very hard to connect the dots.
Right. I mean, it sounds like you're saying that you're not expecting much from the world leaders who have pretty much given a pass to the Saudi royal family for various reasons, but that you feel that there is a rising movement within the Saudi community itself that over time is going to make a difference.
I believe so. I think there is an end for everything, and people do, although they might be in very harsh circumstances, they do come around and figure out a way. You might have infighting in the ruling family over this, not because they are fighting for the rights of the people, but typically in every political environment, people compete for positions of power, and they see the person in power weaken by whatever issue. They will try. They will think this is their best chance in trying to attack and take away the power from that person. And I think you will see this issue happening in Saudi Arabia. There are people in the ruling family who would like to take MBS's position, and they think this is the opportune moment. But this could also lead to greater encouragement of popular section in the country, or even in the military, to take action to gain power or to gain some leverage on MBS. I don't think the U.S. want and have never called for a democratic government in our country, or even a constitutional monarchy in any Gulf country. And they would not support such a thing. I can guarantee you that. Unfortunately, this is the problem with the current and the previous American administrations. Even those who criticize MBS, they said, oh, take MBS out and put another, as if this is some kind of a plantation. You remove one master and put another master, because the slaves do not matter. It should not even be mentioned. That's very disturbing to me, to be honest, because if it comes from an American, especially, where it's supposed to be a government of the people, by the people, for the people.
But apparently that only applies to some of the people some of the time in the terms of the policy of the American government. I hear your frustration. We really appreciate your expert commentary on these, and by all means, please be safe. My guest has been Ali Al-Ahmed. He's the founder and director of the Institute for Gulf Affairs and a scholar and expert on Saudi political affairs. Coming up next, we're going to look at how hard it is these days to fix high-tech electronics. Did I say hard? Heck, it's well nigh impossible, and that's just the way Apple and other tech companies want it. Let's say you want to fix that 2-year-old cell phone or that 3-year-old computer, or let's say you, like me, have a 3-year-old iPad that's in perfect working condition, but it doesn't seem to do anything anymore. Well, I'm a little aggravated. I don't know about you. Let's see how our guest feels about the situation and if he can make sense of this for us. I want to welcome to Background Briefing Michael Hiltzik. He is the Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist for the LA Times, whose column looks at economics and the world of business from the standpoint of people rather than corporations. Michael Hiltzik, welcome to Background Briefing.
Well, thanks, Howard. It's good to be on with you.
How hard is it to fix electronic equipment today? I mean, maybe I don't even have to ask this question because everybody listening knows the answer to this, but let's get it out there. How hard is it?
Sure. Well, it's very hard, especially for products from some manufacturers, and I'm looking at you, Apple. And it's not only hard for laypersons or average consumers to fix and upgrade these products, it's hard for experts who in many cases aren't part of the authorized community of repair persons. And that's because the manufacturers want to control even the people who are professionally repairing or upgrading their products.
Now, authorized sounds like a positive thing. Is authorized a bad thing?
Well, it's certainly a restrictive thing. If you want to be an authorized service repair person for an Apple product or a product from many other manufacturers, you have to pay them a fee. That gives you access to repair manuals. It often gives you access to specialized software that you need in order to make the products that you work on operate after you've opened them up. So, yeah, you don't have to be authorized to fix a lot of these things, but often you do to make sure everything works just perfectly afterwards.
The two effects of this is it makes repairing things a lot more expensive, and it also gives Apple or whoever, it gives them another way to generate revenue that they wouldn't have otherwise. I mean, in your column, you talked about a man named John Bumstead. Could you tell us about his business and how his business is about to get more difficult?
Sure. John Bumstead, he's got a small shop and a small operation in Minnesota. For years, he's been taking old superannuated Apple computers, particularly laptops. He buys them in bulk from recyclers. About 70% of the ones that he buys are serviceable. They can be opened up. The components can be replaced. And he uses the other 30%, he cannibalizes them for the pieces he needs. And then he sells them at very cut rates. You can buy an old Apple laptop for $150 or $200 for him. It works. It works pretty much as well as a brand new Apple laptop does. And the problem that he's run into is that his biggest retail chain goes through Amazon, where he's a third-party seller. Amazon has just reached a deal with Apple in which they're basically going to shut down access to their website to anybody except authorized resellers that's authorized by Apple. So Bumstead and many other repair shops who, like him, are small repair shops, mom and pop or just, you know, guys in the neighborhood, are not going to be able to sell their goods through Amazon. This is going to cut way into their access to the marketplace.
It really is a hit at some small businesses and their entire model for staying in business.
Right. And of course, it's a hit at their customers, too. Bumstead's customers often are students or their parents with students in school. You know, you buy a brand new Apple laptop, it's going to cost you $1,000 or $1,200. And that's the entry level product. If you can buy essentially a good Apple laptop for $200, that's a big savings. And that really opens up access to this technology to thousands of people more.
Now, in writing about this issue, you talked about something called the right of repair movement. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, this is something that's been developing over the last few years. And basically, it is a movement that opposes the habits of big manufacturers to close off the access to their goods. And basically, big manufacturers want to control what you can do with a product of theirs that you buy after you buy it. That really should cut against the grain of consumer rights.
Well, in other words, you don't really own what you thought you owned.
Well, you don't. In many cases, you don't own what you thought you owned. Certainly, you don't have the rights you thought you had to do what you want with it. Certainly, we've seen Apple cases in which they've manipulated the software in their products so that if you open them up, if you open up an iPhone, if you put a different piece of technology in your iPhone, it won't work anymore. It'll be good for a doorstop, but not much else. That really is a violation of what the right to repair people consider to be your right to do what you want with a product you've already bought. And I think they're right about that. The problem they've run into is that although they've introduced legislation in many states that gives consumers the right to acquire repair manuals from manufacturers, to prevent manufacturers from restricting their right to do what they want with their products, none of those has passed yet, but I think the tide is rising.
And how does Apple defend its position that people do not have a right to take an iPhone that they bought and do anything they want with it?
Well, like other manufacturers, what they say is, gee, you know, we're looking out for the consumer because we want to make sure that the product is repaired and serviced properly. Sometimes they'll say, gee, it's dangerous if you let somebody monkey around in the insides of an iPhone or a MacBook or what have you, because they won't know what they're doing. These are the sorts of excuses you hear. I don't think they hold water, because somebody who holds himself out or herself out as a professional repair person basically will either know what they're doing or they'll lose all their customers anyway.
Right.
So
I mean,
I think there's an incentive for these people to operate professionally.
Right. I can see how it might invalidate your warranty if you hand it to somebody who may stick an unauthorized piece of software in it. But that seems to be a different question.
It's a related question, actually. I mean, if you invalidate your warranty just by opening up the product, that's really not proper, especially if you haven't done anything that impairs its operation. So, in fact, many right-to-repair advocates say that sort of invalidation of a warranty is improper and that shouldn't be permitted either.
I see. Now, Apple is not unique in this regard, although it's always fun to beat up on Apple. I've written about Apple a few times in my career, and I'm still waiting for a callback from the army of public relations people they have working for them, but never got one.
Yeah, you'll be waiting a while, I suspect.
Anyway, but you point out that refrigerators and other household appliances now come with electronic components or passwords that can be reset only with equipment or a code held by a manufacturer. They have kill switches that can make a product inoperable, that farmers in the Midwest have been in a battle with John Deere or over its refusal to provide full access to software code embedded in its tractors. And, you know, the Apple situation, they use proprietary screws that need special tools to remove when they could have just used an ordinary screw. And they glue their pieces into their insides so that buyers cannot monkey with them or extend the memory or add memory without essentially destroying the device. I guess the idea here is that they have to create a high-quality device so that you'll buy it in the first place, and pay a premium price for it, but they also want to compel consumers to replace that equipment as soon as possible.
That's true. There's a lot of planned obsolescence out there, and the obsolescence period gets shorter and shorter all the time. You're right. There's been a long battle with John Deere. Farmers, if you know farmers, they are, as a class, very resourceful people. And they've been accustomed to, when their tractor breaks down, they generally have known how to fix it and get it back in the field. As these products get more sophisticated, yes, they have more software in them. They have more computerized components. These are all opportunities for the manufacturer to block easy repairs. John Deere, one of the problems is that John Deere wants you, when your tractor breaks down, and wants you to take it to an authorized repair shop. Well, the farm zone tends to be a rural zone. You may be talking about a repair shop that's hundreds of miles away, and your tractor is going to be out of service for the better part of a growing season. That's not going to work. So there's been a lot of agitation to get John Deere to back down or to get legislation in Midwestern states to prevent this from happening.
I mean, the other way that Apple has planned obsolescence built into its product is, of course, they make it so that they don't perpetually update the software, but they'll only update the software of a model for a certain period of time. So even though my 3-year-old iPad works perfectly, it is virtually a doorstop, even though it's in perfect working order.
That's right. It used to be a principle in the software business to make sure that software was backwards compatible. That is, when you rewrote the software or put new functions in, it would still be compatible with older machines. That backward period is shrinking all the time. And once again, the more sophisticated the product gets, the greater the obstacles to making sure that they remain modernized and that they remain compatible with every new iteration. Apple brings out a new iteration of its operating system pretty much on schedule once a year. And each time, the older models of iMacs or MacBooks or iPhones or what have you fall off the grid. In fact, this is exactly what John Bumstead does for a living. He goes and he gives these old products that no longer are compatible with the newest software, he gives them a second life by reinstalling the old software and making them operate again.
Apple caters to a very premium audience, so I mean, maybe at one level we're taking away business from Apple by doing this, but at some level we're also making Apple products affordable to people who might not be able to pay for new Apple products.
I think if you're Apple, you would, to a certain extent, like this to continue going on, because what you're doing essentially is you're bringing new customers into the Apple community early at a point when they might not enter because the products are so expensive. Yeah. You can create an Apple customer for life if you can introduce him or her to the technology at a young age.
A corollary issue here is upgrading. What do you do when you want more memory?
You know, we really do need to take a close look at the cost of restrictions on upgrading your own technology. I don't mean to beat up on Apple. I am an Apple customer in many, many ways. We have a lot of Apple devices. You know, my family is an Apple family. But I just, frankly, bought a new MacBook. And because it's not upgradable, I can't at some point down the line decide that I want to put more memory in it. I can't down the line decide that I want to put more storage in it. So I have to make those decisions today. And the decisions are made at Apple's premium prices. If you want to double the RAM memory in an Apple MacBook, it will cost you $200. If you want to buy the same amount of memory from Amazon or Best Buy and put it in yourself in a computer that you can open up, it might cost you $70. So you can see how this sort of control really just feeds into the business model of these big manufacturing companies.
Now, another aspect of this that we haven't touched on yet is how ecologically wasteful it is for all these products to go obsolescent so quickly. And, well, then what do you do with them?
That's right. Essentially, as one of my sources on this article pointed out, basically you're condemning people to be part of the throwaway culture. I think those of us who can cast our minds back long enough can remember when there was a TV repairman who, when your television stopped working, he would come to the house or she would come to the house, would get his or her hands in the innards, pull out vacuum tubes or fix what needs to be fixed. Now, we don't do that. I mean, if your television stops working, you're much more likely to toss it out, to put it in the landfill. Maybe you will bring it to your nearest Best Buy to have them recycle it, but often you won't. Apple talks about how ecologically and environmentally sustainable their products are, but they really are designing these things so that they do not have the longest life that they could.
They're only sustainable if you recycle them properly, right? I mean, if you just throw them away, they're no different than toxic waste when you consider the trace elements of mercury and other dangerous substances that are in these. I mean, tell me if I'm wrong here.
No, you're right. And I think people don't really have any conception of what the volume is of the trash that accumulates because of this throwaway culture. I mean, Californians alone are throwing away something in the neighborhood of 46,000 iPhones a day. That's just stunning, but that's what the numbers show. I mean, that is a lot of trash that's being created that doesn't have to be.
You mentioned earlier that there is a movement to do something about this. So remind us where things stand on the legislative front, and is Apple taking this quietly?
Well, they're taking it quietly, but they're not taking it lying down.
Okay.
There have been right to repair bills that were introduced this year in about 20 states. None passed. There was one that was introduced in California by Assemblywoman Susan Eggman of Stockton that got boxed up in multiple committees and basically strangled at birth. The right to repair people, they're not that concerned about this. They think that the movement is growing. This year, there were 20 bills. Next year, maybe there will be 40 bills. And as legislators get more and more used to the idea, it's a nonpartisan idea. You have Republicans who are angry about these sorts of restrictions and Democrats. Sooner or later, one of these bills is going to pass. But Apple, the high-tech community, the technology manufacturing community, they have lots and lots and lots of money, and they spend it lavishly in lobbying to block these sorts of bills. So the battle is going to continue, but I think over time, eventually, it's going to be won by the right to repair.
Well, Michael Hiltzik, thank you for shining a light onto this problem. It's something that we really, everybody out there confronts in terms of their everyday use of technology. Michael Hiltzik is a columnist, a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist. He writes about the business world from the standpoint of people rather than corporations. He writes for the LA Times. Michael Hiltzik, thank you for joining us on Background Briefing today.
Thanks for having me.
That is it for today's show. This has been Howard Bloom sitting in for Ian Masters, the host of Background Briefing. I want to thank our producer, Graham Fitzgibbon, for all his help. You can find this program online at backgroundbriefing.org, where you can subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Please rate and review this show on iTunes, Google Play, and SoundCloud, and share today's program with friends, family, and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. Tune in tomorrow. Shirley Jihad will be sitting in for Ian Masters.
Standing along the side of the pickup truck, a shot rang out in the night, just when everything seemed right. Another headline written down in America. The guy that lived next door in 305 took the kids to the park and disappeared by half past. One more light goes out in the